but we're doing a few people today, and later on we're moving to Vegas. A few I told you this today. Mr. Schulitz, welcome, and all our guests who are here. We're doing the interviews of 35 people who are used to far. Out of, I'm looking for the three nominations. Not this, this is our last thing. This is a thing that I'm coming to the end of suddenly elect myself. So Mr. Schulitz, would you ask me to do things or two things you've gone through your TV? You are one of those special persons. So if you just touch your TV, tell us about yourself. And more or less in the same breath, you take 2 to 3 minutes to do that. You can go up to 5 minutes as well. Also to try and assist us to consider your nomination to be a mantra child. Basically why you should consider you to be on the board of that day. From there we'll do some questions. I'll give you a moment at the end as well when everybody is finished their questions, just to say a closing remark. So I won't deny you the opportunity. Welcome sir, and it's over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning to all the members today. Can you hear me?
Yes.
And thank you very much. I'm very humbled for me being here. I was born in Port Elizabeth about good 52 years ago. My date, my birth date is one of those cases where I was born in a particular year, but Foreign Affairs or Home Affairs decided that I was born in another year. So I'll stick to what is in my jumper, and that is 1952, but in fact I was born in 1954, but it doesn't matter. I was born in Port Elizabeth, grew up in New Brighton. I grew up under the same similar circumstances, all black people, under very dire circumstances, parents not working, struggling. But it occurred to me early on, Chairperson and the members, that, you know, out of adversity, there must be, you know, something positive coming out of my family, through my family. And I was quite determined that I'm going to be something in South Africa, in spite of all the difficulties and the circumstances that I grew under. My primary high school was not easy, similarly to all many, many black people in this country. But I went through because of PSG, principally because I wanted to be something in this country. I finished my high school at Newell High School, one of the popular high schools in Port Elizabeth. And then, unfortunately, I didn't have money to go to university. I worked at the post office as a clerk. And at that point, and I wanted to be a medical technologist because I was foreseeing a situation where these skills called medical technology were quite scarce in our country. So I was very keen to pursue that. But when I joined the post office and started interacting with people, you know, and so on, unfortunately, that changed. I was more interested in the economic side of things. In 1976, I didn't have enough money, but I decided that, okay, because I wanted to be educated, I'm going to go to Portia. If somebody is not going to give me money there, then I'm going to have a problem. So I went to University of Portia without money. I was very fortunate to be received by Reverend McKinney Stoffie then, who actually supported me financially at University of Portia in 1976. Unfortunately, of course, I didn't finish the degree because of everything that happened in that year. But of course, that brought more burden on my shoulders in the sense that here was I, supported by somebody, okay? Now, here is a year, academic year, going down the tube. So I had to go back and work, and I worked for a while, but because of this deal, this determination, that without education, I didn't see myself really achieving much and contributing much in our country. I then went back to Portia in 1978. registered a commerce degree, economics, and industrial psychology, and I'm going to explain the combination just now. I arrived at Fort Hare, things went on smoothly. I did my first year successfully, second year supported by Shell, who gave me a full scholarship, which was fantastic. I continued second year, I succeeded second year, third year, 1980. We were troublesome on campus. And that was the end of my academic career at Fort Hare. At the end of my BCom degree, third year, and I left Fort Hare because we excelled. That meant that I had to study part time through UNISA. And I did that. I lost a lot of credit through UNISA. And I had to start almost the second year. And I did that, and I persevered, and I completed my degree in 1983, majoring in economics and industrial science. Now, why the combination? I knew that I was very interested in economics, but I also understood that without people in the economic system, okay, we wouldn't achieve much. Hence, I wanted to understand the people side of the economy, if you like, if you get what I'm saying. So hence the combination of industrial psychology and economics. So I went at Brewery, that's where I really cut my teeth. I worked for Brewery for 7 years, and again deliberately because I saw myself as a leader one day in our country. I wanted to have a full sense of business in totality. So I moved from HR to commercial to finance to operations, because I wanted to make sure that I oriented myself properly so that I can understand what really makes the business tick. So I was very privileged in terms of being given the opportunity for me to do that in SA Brewery. And I must say that I was very fortunate also to have been mentored by one of the very effective leaders in business in my book in SA Brewery at the time, a guy called Norman Adame. Norman Adame is heading up SAB Miller in the United States right now. A very, very fantastic leader. So I was very privileged to have been guided and being mentored by people like that. So I did that for 7 years at Brewery. 1990, it was now the advent of the change in our country, as we all know. I was very much attracted by a venture where IBM, ISM at the time, was quite prepared to fund a foundation where we would actually bring our exiles back to our country. And I was actually approached by Ruakosa to come and establish the foundation and run it. And I must say, Chairperson and the members, it was very gratifying for me to go to Washington, to go in the UK, to go in Australia, to go and meet our people, talk about the advent of the new South Africa, talk about the need of your skills coming back into our country, talk about the processes that we could follow for you to be able to contribute to the emerging new South Africa. That's where we met people like Danita Baloy, who completed a degree in Washington. We met Professor Renosi today. They came through all those that foundation. The way we did it, Chairperson, was that we established internships for the returning graduates where they would actually spend 6 months in the world of work, applying their trade and getting some experience and be paid the salary. And of course, if the employer would like what one sees, then of course there's a potential of permanent employment in that sense. We did that for a good 3 years. We set up the foundation, we went and mobilized more funding, and then we got more of the internships being placed in the corporate South Africa. And that was very, very gratifying for me. I left there and I joined Transnet. I must confess that I made a mistake, principally because at the time, the culture of Transnet simply didn't suit me. But I was able to move very rapidly from an HR manager to general manager, assistant general manager in the Transnet group. But it was very clear to me that this culture here was not conducive. That's where then I got into oil and gas, because I just joined the engine at the time, 1993, 1994. There, chairperson and the members. I've got to pick up skills around what is called business turnaround. I was part of the project that spent 8 months looking at not restructuring, but re-engineering engine in its entirety. And we spent 8 years as executives actually putting together that. And I was part of that process, and I picked up a lot of skills in terms of business turnaround, and that was very, very much a good experience for me. After that, then I joined the HR team as an executive member of the engine executive committee. And I did that for a while, and then I was posted on assignment to the holding company of engines called Petronas in Malaysia. I spent 3 years in Malaysia, in Petronas, in the marketing group. After that, I came back and again was appointed to head up and implement the engine growth strategy in Africa. I was responsible for 14 countries in Africa, including Burundi, Rwanda, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Tanzania, trying to establish engines in those countries. And it was quite an experience to have to deal with the various cultures, you know, in our continent, and of course the difficulties of setting up operations on the ground. But that was a very, very good experience for me, both from an operational point of view, where you set up stations, you set up offices on the ground, and it was fabulous. It was a fabulous experience. And then came the time when our government asked, and of course if you asked by government, you have to accept on the few, to help us to establish the national oil company of our country, Petro-SA. It was very humbling to have been asked by the government to do that. And we as a team that we put together were able to establish what is known today as Petro-SA, the national oil company of our country. The experience there was simply again establishing things on the ground, putting together pieces of assets and put them together so that you commercialize them and make money. And that's what we did for good 3 years. And there you picked up the experience on the refinery side. I loved the fact that when I arrived at Petro-SA, the engineers in Waterway were looking at me and saying, who the hell is he and where is he coming from? I mean, there's no black who understands this kind of thing. You know, where does he come from? Well, I said, look, you know, I'm here to do a job. We're all here to do a job. And we have a task of establishing an oil company for this country. And we all have a contribution to make, so we better work together, you know, so that we can achieve the goals of Petro-SA in South Africa. We did that, Chairperson, and again, experience in leading, you know, teams, experience in putting together the vision of Petro-SA, and begin to actually sell and galvanize everybody around that vision, so that people can buy into that, and we can begin then to implement, you know, the objectives that will arrive, realize that vision. And we did that. And then after that, Chairperson, then I decided that the BEE space was opening up, and I could leverage the experience that I've acquired in terms of pursuing, you know, some projects. One of the projects that we identified was that Sasol was intending to sell the FFF refinery in Devon. And they were looking at selling their 49% share of the stake, and we're very interested in that because we believe that we had the experience and the knowledge, you know, of the business. But unfortunately, that didn't succeed. And I guess, you know, when you fail sometimes, that contributes to your own experience and your learning curve as well, and that didn't work out. Now, just to finalize then my background, I used to play rugby in the old days. The South African Rugby Union, the old SARU, where we used to say that there can never be normal sport in an abnormal society. And therefore, this country belongs to everybody, and everybody should play sport if one can play it and represent one country. So because of those themes of the past, of playing rugby and sort of having no stance at the time, I was invited to join the board of SA Rugby Now, FLRC, the commercial side of it, the commercial side and the union side. So I was invited to join the commercial side because of my commercial experience and my commercial knowledge. So I joined as a board in 2004, and in 2006 I was asked to act as the chairperson of the board, and then this April I was confirmed as the chairperson of the board for the next 2 years. In addition to that, I chair the executive committee of SLRC Pty Ltd. I chair the remuneration committee of SLRC Pty Ltd. Next year, January, I'm chairing the committee or the company called SANZA, which is South Africa, Australia, and New Zealand coming together, managing Super 14 and Tri-Nations. And I'm chairing that for the next 2 years. Mr. Chairperson, that's me and my background. The reason why I believe I could be considered to play a role in SABC is that SABC resembles, in a way, SARC, in the sense that SARC has got a commercial arm that is going to be commercialized so that they can make a lot of money to support the amateur side of the business so that they can begin to develop the future springboard that will come over on the commercial side and leverage and rebrand it so that we can make more money. If you look at SABC, you've got the public broadcasting side of it, which is the delivery of the public good, okay, which is arguably should be free, arguably. And then you've got the commercial side of SABC that you have to maximize. You know, the assets of SABC, including the content and everything, and make money so that you can then support, you know, the objective of informing, educating, entertaining the nation. So I bring that experience, which is current. I also bring skills in the areas of the people area, which I understand quite thoroughly. I bring skills in the area of leadership and strategy, because I've done it. I'll bring skills in the area of business turnaround, or if we need to restructure or re-look at the business, improve, you know, systems and processes. I've done that. I'll bring that to bear on SABC. And most importantly, Chairperson and members, I'll bring a lot of skill in the area of what I call enterprise governance. What I mean by enterprise governance is that any business, including SABC, has got a business performance dimension of it. It's got what is called the compliance and risk management dimension of it. Now, unfortunately, you cannot run on the business side and make money and actually break in each and every law or every regulation that governs, you know, this business. So you need to strike a balance. So how do you strike the balance? The CEOs always face the tension of having to harmonize the two. There is an opportunity to make money. Let me grab it now. But the corporate governance calls on me to follow the processes. Now the question is, how does the CEO manage this tension in such a way that you actually can do and grow this business successfully? That I've done, okay. We're doing that in SARC right now to make sure that, you know, risk management is very, very important. I was reading the documentation on the SAPC annual report where they were saying that, in fact, they're going to look at solidifying what is called risk management system. Now, Chairperson is what is called the enterprise-wide risk management system that is actually typically being implemented in organizations as large as SABC with 3.9 billion revenue. So that system covers everything of the business. And it's got to be managed, it's got to be monitored from the board downwards so that we make sure that we actually manage our risks as effectively as possible. The other thing that I saw as a challenge when I was reading the documentation, SABC annual report, was that there's an overwhelming in the revenue mix. You get 66% coming from advertising, and then you've got 90% coming from 9% coming from sponsorship. Now, why am I raising this? Is that it's a risk to over rely on one source of revenue, any business. One is to start diversifying that business. such a way that if advertising revenue doesn't work, then your business doesn't collapse. You've got to take care of 3.5, you know, billion cost of SABC, and therefore you cannot move on the line on one single source of revenue. So in my view, the challenge of the entire balance, maybe collection of license fees, maybe needs to be stepped up a little bit. Maybe looking at other alternatives of revenue is an area that we have to look at. So that is in a nutshell, that's me, Shepard.
Thank you very much. You've come a long way. You really come a long way. The issue related to the challenge of revenue. The current situation is that 80% comes from commercial activities, 70% from licensing. Let me just say commercial is 97%, licensing 70%, about 80% advertising, only 3% from treasury. So you are never correct in terms of over reliance on commercial activities. But maybe you are looking at the old figure, the new one, the one that I'm taking out. Members, here we are. Let me give over to you. It's for
Thank you. Briefly, could you give us your view on the current CSL saga that is unfolding with regard to the SABC, particularly with regard to whether you as really a commercial entity within our broader society, or do you think that sport belongs to the people of the nation? I was interested in you saying that you really wanted to build up a massive commercial rugby enterprise, so wanted to use that money for amateur training and promotion. Can you give me some idea of how SA Rugby now, what are we talking about for people who are kind of money that's being made, kind of money that's being found back to amateur sports? And if you would be put onto the board, how would you see your role in attempting to promote it, say, rugby, given the environment that it's in today's program? Do you think it would be any conflict?
With the dichotomy, FRMP on the commercial side, total revenue is in the region of 350 million. And part of that amount of money obviously pays professional players. Okay, Sumok. Now, in the last 15 years, we've spent something like 700 million in the amateur development. Now, if you ask me as to what the results are of that investment, and I'm going to say to you, it's a shocking result. It's very clear that the investment was not put into proper use. It probably didn't go where it was supposed to have gone in terms of player development at a grassroots level, so that you've got a feeder of greater numbers of people that can compete at the top. And that is what happened. And that's unfortunate. So, in my view, it was money wasted in this sense. So we then dedicate significant amount of money into the amateur side, principally because without doing that, you will not get the framework that you've got to commercialize. It's a clear matter. Now, coming back to the question of Forge and SABC. When I was reading the annual report, clearly the area, the fact that they lost the rugby, okay, and rugby rights, had an impact on the contribution of sport as a unit within SABC. In fact, SA Rugby and SABC are in constant discussion around opportunities that could arise for SABC to be able to reestablish, that business of advertising and broadcasting sports and rugby in particular. And those discussions were fresh and lovely to re-establish that. The opportunity, though, is that because we're locked into a broadcasting agreement with News Corp, which comes to an end at the end of 2010, then I guess what we're doing is paving the way and looking at how we should actually bring SABC on board. And the reason for wanting to do so is simple, that SABC has got mass appeal and a massive reach of our people in the villages. And therefore, it is imperative that SA Rugby should actually bring SABC on board so that rugby becomes a truly, truly, truly national sport. Now, coming back to the PSL SABC, I don't have the details, but it's unfortunate that SABC hasn't had the right, okay? I don't have the details as intimate as you do, but typically what would happen is obviously want to protect this right as much as possible. And I must also confess that this right has become quite expensive because, I mean, if you talk about global sport, you're talking about something like in the region of 7.8 billion that is available in revenue, global sport. In this country, we had the piece in rugby of something like 3.5 billion that is available, you know, that we should actually be leveraging. So what I'm saying is that because of that pool of revenue, the broadcasters are now seeing the opportunity of taking money for themselves. Okay, and as a result, the rights are now becoming expensive. So you should be able then to, you know, be in a position where you can really, you know, negotiate on a kind of a stronger footing than you could have done before. Now, it's a question of money all the time as to whether SABC would have been prepared to pay 1.6 billion rand for this right. I don't know. But I would have thought that we should have done everything possible to protect this right, because once you lose them, it becomes extremely difficult to get them back. I mean, you've seen in rugby now, okay? Those rights are gonna take a while before, you know, SABC is able to. But of course, we'll do the best we can. And of conflict of interest, I don't see conflict of interest. I see an advantage in the sense that I could leverage my knowledge of SA Rugby, where SA Rugby is going, and help the best I can to bring the parties together. Okay, now we have understood SABC's imperative, and now understand SA Rugby's imperative. The best I can do is to bring the parties together. Now, where SA Rugby's rights are going to be discussed, and SABC board, then of course, at the point where the decision is going to be made, any board who is serious about one's integrity will have to reach with one side. Yeah. So that's how I see it. But I see a lot of advantage of just continuing to bring the parties together, continue to discuss the opportunities that are available, okay, as we're discussing a week or so ago about the British Iron Line tour of 2009, where we think there could be opportunities that could be leveraged, you know, for the benefit of the country.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I also used to play rugby when I was a lot smaller. But always when I hear rugby, I think of, you know, that old thing, rugby, Sammy's car, and Chevrolet, a couple of years on the side. Now, you're a man to my heart of your, I mean, you were able to fuel the Chevrolet and to supply the beers and involved in the rugby. That's good. I wanted to ask questions about the sport, but I'm not going to do so. However, I seem to be having a bit of a problem. I look at your CV and it's dated January 2004, and also the attached document only go up to 2003 in terms of your work record. Now, apart from your involvement in rugby, you say rugby, can you just give us some information as to what you've been doing since 2003 when you left Petro SA, and what you are currently doing in terms of your employment, and also some indication as to the number and detail of boards that you are involved in our actorships and so on. I don't know it. Now, the interesting thing to look at is you serve there, but then at the back of the TV, I don't know if it's expired or you're not in the room or whatever the case is. Just your characterization in terms of those things.
Thank you very much. I apologize for that. I actually updated the TV and I sent it through about a good 9 days ago. Because I realized when I looked at the information that was provided when I was nominated, I realized they used the old information. I updated it and I sent through. And it was confirmed as we proceed. So my apologies for that. As I was saying that in 2004, oil businesses, and of course BE, you know, is quite slow in terms of, you know, realizing, you know, some opportunities. I then got into the business of what is called headhunting, particularly at the director level, at the CEO, COO, general manager level. So that's what I'm currently doing now. I'm developing leadership through deployment and finding people for right opportunities and then coaching them so that they can make sure that they succeed. So that's what I do right now. Okay. In terms of board involvement, it is essentially SA Rugby Board. I was serving on the Piedmont Board, which holds the Palace of Gambling, until end of June or July, where there was a buyout. Okay, and they're new shareholders now, so I don't accept that anymore. So my directorship, my involvement at that level is principally at Rugby level. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mr. Farrell.
Mr. Chairman, the Public Broadcasting Corporation is considered to be a public broadcaster. Now, the European Broadcasting Union defined the public broadcaster simply as a broadcasting made for the public, financed by the public, and controlled by the public. But UNESCO then defined it a bit different to say that it must require a number of things. One, information, educational tools, accessible to all and meant for all people, and lastly, above all, equality in terms of you know, everybody considered to be the same. Now, the South African Broadcasting Corporation, it's got that element that you also talk quite a lot about in the commercial section. Now, the commercial broadcasting, its main purpose one is to, it's for private, it's a commercial, it's a private, its main purpose is to make money, and it's an investment for its investors. In terms of your view, what is that we can do to balance the two? Taking into account the role of the public broadcaster to inform, to educate, and to entertain, and then this other part to get money, you know, equity for its shareholders, and to do as much as it can so that it also has a certain effect. What is that could be done by the board to balance this issue of the broadcasting corporation without compromising quality as in terms of equality as in terms of the UNESCO? Then the second question would be, Mr. Schumann, is that there is a perception, and I'm not sure if this perception is informed by either the type of mode of production that our country is, capitalist society, or there is a perception that the South African Broadcasting Corporation is much more biased to middle class, upper class, LSM 6 to 10, living standard measure, 6 to 10 or 8 to 10. And majority of your people in South Africa, black and white, poor and LSM 1 to 5, are not really given as much. The soapies, the programs, the adverts depict much more of the standard of life, that's middle class. So I'm not so sure whether this is true or not true in terms of your own thinking, whether this can be changed by the board, you know, to reflect much more of the entire society of the country. And the last point is in terms of the sport. Mr. Swalt said, you didn't ask about the sport, but I'm not going to venture there. We are told that South African rugby and South African cricket, they are sponsored by far the fastest set of soccer. I mean, this is what has informed the decision of the Premier Soccer League to actually give the sponsorship to Super Sport. But fundamental to the entire thing, which is quite sad, is the fact that majority of South African soccer fans and lovers, they listen to soccer on radio. And this rights too has gone, and they are not necessarily giving to Super Sport. Super Sport is not a radio station that they run on their own. They are just lying there. Because the money that PSL won, it should be equivalent to that of rugby, to that of cricket, but then we are approaching 210. What is your view on terms of when it comes to commercial interest and the public interest? That's my question, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Kumalo. Can I start with the second point around what the SABC is providing for and the promotion of middle class? My understanding is that SABC Corporate is an anchor brand. And then under that, there are sub-brands called SABC One that caters for youth, SABC Two that caters for conservative, relatively old people, and SABC Three that caters for trendy in this LFM of between age and gender. Now that's my understanding really wrong there. Now coming back to your question and trying to answer it, the question must answer as to what it is, because SABC is part of the reconstruction of South Africa. It's part of the reconstruction of South Africa. And therefore, SABC needs to play a role as a contribution in terms of reconstruction of South Africa. And it cannot then do things that are inconsistent with what South Africa wants to be and the values and everything else. Now, if there is a disconnect between what South Africa wants to be and the various public within South Africa in terms of their needs, then SABC has got to look at that and see how best that can be served. Yeah, on top of that, I've got another question. If you look at SABC 2, conservative that is in position, I just wonder about my grandmother who stays in the village in Ubungu, as to whether it catered for, okay, within the various channels of SABC. I'm not too sure. Okay. Now, that puts, you know, this comment puts on top of what you've asked, as to whether, in fact, you know, the various communities and their needs have been catered for. I am not sure they are being catered for. So it's a matter that you need to look at, in my view. The first question is about balancing delivery of the public goods and the commercial business. Now, you need resources to deliver the public good. Okay, if the public good is going to be delivered through 3.5 billion costs, you need to get that money from somewhere, right? If our government, because of competing priorities, cannot contribute, okay, beyond 100 billion rand, then the board must look at where the revenue or where the resources could be found. And unfortunately, if somebody puts money in a business, one expects to return and is appreciated. Okay. Now the question is, how do you satisfy the shareholder, but at the same time have enough resources to deliver on the mandate of delivering the public good? I think that's a challenge that the SABC board is going to have in terms of saying, this money that has been generated, 3.9, okay, the bulk of that money should be used primarily to actually deliver the public good. And that's a challenge that we've got to confront and see how we can actually sort of juggle around that question. The third point is around sport. The question of the price of rights is a function of what the market is prepared to pay at any given time.
people who sell rice today in Zimbabwe, for example, the market actually favors Zimbabwe. But unfortunately, you are locked into a long-term contract that ends 2010. And I'm not too sure how the market is going to be there. It may favor the broadcaster at that time. I don't know. So the rice price is a function of what the broadcaster or those who want those rice are going to pay. Now, whether soccer's rights are more expensive than rugby rights is a function of the brand, okay? Is a function of the appeal, of course, is a function of the access, okay, of the wider audience. Okay, because remember, the broadcaster also benefits from audiences. Okay? If you've got larger numbers of people that can access, then it's better for you, okay, in terms of viewership. So it depends on the brand, the ability to access large numbers of people, and that will actually come into the brand, and of course the market, what the market is investing. So the debate is whether rugby is more appealing from a right price point of view. That's a cricket. It's a debate. We can talk about it now, but it just depends on what the market is prepared to pay. Okay. And of course, your understanding of the value of the rights. The value of the rights, from your point of view, depends on the brand value, your brand value. It depends on the ability to access greater numbers of people, okay, in terms of viewership, and so on and so on.
Thank you. Mr. Chume, it seems that SABC needs a transformation. Transformation, where if I follow on the question of Mr. Kumalo earlier, where it tends to cater for the LSM, let's say, every 6 to 10. Now, how would you go about if you take your personal experience at SA Rugby, where transformation seems either to start or come to a standstill, to look at the black people, you know, in a team, and everybody competing for the wing position. No further. Many years after we attained our freedom, it doesn't seem that the SA Rugby is a good place to start to say, this is my success, you know, in terms of that. I doubt if the rugby rights, the broadcasting rugby rights, will ever come back to the directly to Africa. I mean, if you spend some time, the amount of time that you spend in the honey tank through the Rupert Murdoch group, I don't see them ever coming back. And I think the same, my fear, now that PSL has wandered off to super sport and the kind of money that they're living in, that they will ever come back and accept that they have responsibility for LSM downwards. Within that, his own challenge of chairperson, we've seen with cricket, where these rights are exclusive to super sport. The attendance dwindles to really nobody, literally nobody. Only the cricket players and his girlfriend, his wife sitting there and asking off. But look, with good camera work, he doesn't pick that up. When you literally go there, you will see hardly anybody. And there's a fear is it could take the same route for, excuse me, rugby and soccer if it continues to stay basically in Australia. My last question, just your comment on it, your stint as a CEO at Petro SA, I think the then minister thought you did a good job, you know, for what you've been deployed to do, intend to do, and you fulfilled all your tasks. But parallel to that, a renowned columnist in Cape Town papers, at least, Rona Kadari, said, you basically resigned because of nepotism and skew affirmative action, hence that you had to resign. And, you know, Minister was just trying to say, you fulfilled your task. Thank you, sir.
Chairman, thank you, sir. Let me start with the last question. The Petro SA scheme came to an end in 2003. And this was as a result of an incident that happened to me. We went out to look for oil producing fields in Africa as part of our mandate. And we found oil producing fields in Gabon that were affordable, that were already producing in terms of oil. And we then entered into discussions and negotiations with the Gabonese government to get equity out of these producing oil fields. And of course, you know, the process would go through the board and then the minister and everybody else approving and so on. And this was $1 million. There were about 3 blocks. Total $1 million. All of them. Now, we'd already made commitments with Gabonese government, everything was fine. We had cash reserves in the business, so there was no problem in terms of pay. When it comes to the day of paying bills, then the Minister of Finance said no. And that was it. And that was at the time when the Minister of Finance was busy preparing for his budget. Now, the business, and myself in particular, took a huge knock from a credibility and a reputation point of view. The cash reserves of the business were in the public domain, where they were known. And therefore, the ability to pay was not questioned. Okay. So the Gabonese government comes back and says, what's this? You guys are going about, you know, about this cash amount that you've got, and you desire to expand your portfolio of oil blocks so that you can begin to have, you know, oil, you know. That oil cannot come straight here, but you'll be able to sell it in the market and get money, I'll pay for it. All of a sudden, you cannot pay $1 million for that. So we got a terrible knock in the market in terms of our credibility and myself in particular. And that was the beginning of my unhappiness in PetroSA. That I didn't believe that I thought I had the money to do this thing when in fact I didn't. And nobody explained to me why the finance minister was unable to reach $1 million for this block. And then at that time, that I cannot continue leading this organization thinking that I'm doing the right thing, whereas somebody else thinks that we're doing something stupid by actually going out of our borders and actually look for, you know, oil opportunities, okay, which was the phenomenon. So I said to the board then that I'm unlikely to renew my contract because this environment here is not conducive for me as a business person to actually lead this organization accordingly. So I communicated that to the minister. The minister was not happy, but that was my wish. Now, in the same year, remember, PetroSA was being established at the same time being fine-tuned, okay, so that we can be commercially oriented and deliver on our objectives. And there was a lot of also of rationalization that was taking place throughout the business. Same year, we were having a shutdown to overhaul the refinery. Okay, same year. So, towards that time, it was May when we actually stopped the refinery to overhaul it. It was already a, you know, this shows because the outages were so many and were struggling. And there was no way that it would postpone the overhaul of the refinery to allow the whole restructuring of the business to take place. Because otherwise we're risking, you know, the refinery itself and the people that are working there. So we're then forced to actually shut down the refinery and overhaul it. Okay? And that's a kind of exciting thing over each and every 3 years to do that. Okay. And of course, that was taking place. We had problems on the labor front, people that we actually employed as casual contractors to help us. So it was not an easy, nice, you know, shutdown, as we call it. Okay, but the shutdown was done. Completed, we recommissioned the refinery. Okay. A month later, the refinery blew up. The water heating boilers, two of them, blew up completely. And of course, the refinery wouldn't operate. Okay. We had one boiler in stock. Now it takes not less than a month to actually build a new boiler for the refinery. Not here in the country, but overseas. So those delays, okay, that incident hit me badly as a leader of Petro SA, because that's not what I was expecting. The refinery has been overhauled. It's now ready to give us another good 3 years in terms of throughput. And all of a sudden, when I recommissioned the refinery after that cycle, now I get two boilers now actually backing up. Okay. That was a big blow for me at the organization. Okay. Now, it was taking place at the time when I was actually preparing to exit anyway. Okay. So we then agreed with the minister that if you understand that I'm actually preparing to exit anyway, okay, maybe I should not continue. Okay, I should leave the organization. That's what happened.
Now, coming back to the question of transformation.
Rugby is failing to transform this body, having put 700 million in development, as I've just mentioned. And the measure is very simple. A is lack of bold leadership. That's number one. Secondly, Rugby has got structural deficiencies in the sense that the president cannot tell the bull to transform, because the bull is a unit that is independent of the Rugby whole. Okay. The constitution of the Rugby is such that the leadership of the Rugby cannot go to the bull and say, I want transformation. Okay. This is what we need to do. This is what we need to do. We don't have constitutional right to do so. Now, to change the constitution is going to require the same people that want to force those change. Okay? Because we need to have 3/4 of the council to approve the changes of the constitution so that we can do what we want to do. Aligned with that, SLAP has formulated transformation policy. And it's very clear, well done, well spelled out. But the implementation of that becomes difficult because the people down on the ground, okay, don't have the will to actually facilitate the transformation that we want to achieve. Now, Brian Aban came about to start today, not because of anything, because of the quotas that were there at the time. Okay. Now, the conclusion that they developed has arrived is that there is no other way of transforming this thing and get our people through the system, okay, so that they can actually represent their country, except putting quotas in there. That's the thinking in SLRP right now. Okay. Now, whether that's going to be finalized next year when we reconvene in the council is a different matter entirely. But SLRP has recognized that if we go at this pace, it will take a long time to change the business, to change the complexion. Not for the sake of it, to make sure that the right people with the right skills actually can compete with anybody else and represent their country. Now, underpinning that challenge is a question of equalizing the opportunity. People talk about merit. I'm for merit anytime. But the question is, what is the fundamental underpinning for merit to take place? There's one sufficient and necessary condition for merit to take place, and that is equal opportunity. Now, you cannot then convincingly talk about merit when in fact there are no equal opportunities. Now, we need to equalize the opportunity. We need our government to help us to make sure that the facilities and schools and everywhere, club level, are the same throughout, that the coaching standards and coaching resources and everything else that goes with it is equal across our country. And then we can say, when this boys come to this level of representing our country, there's no question about no color anymore. It's a question of, can you do it? Have you had the right opportunity, like everybody else, for you to represent our country? So that is the challenge that we're having in the country right now.
Can I just follow up on that, sir?
No. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. President.
No problem.
Mr. Chuk, having listened to you by a conference and how how you are hired on the services. And the part that I want to ask about is the crisis policy appears to be one of the economies. And I'd like you to ask about your opinion on the program in the CDC that is meant to empower women, especially the women in the field of agriculture. I think I have a concern of the time when this program, one of the programs are on the CDC. If you want to empower poor women in the rural areas and you come up with a program like 2 million, that is in the morning at 6 o'clock, a person will say to me, rise in the community, I think in the Boko, for instance, or as you said, in some time, how do you expect me to be at that time to have that information? I want to.
Chairperson, thanks. One must assume that for a program to be shown on SABC, it must have been as a result of some research. Okay, some research. Surely, I cannot imagine that I would sit in an SABC board and approve the content of a program without having had the benefit of how did this come about? Okay, surely there's a need identified there, okay, women in this case, of culture. Where are they? Okay, can they access this program? Okay, how many do have TV, for example? And all those questions must come into the research program. So as to inform you exactly the nature of the content of the program, okay, the timing of it, okay, because you can take into account, you know, our mamas, you know, waking up in the morning and going to the field, whatever they do, okay, but perhaps there's a slot at which the majority of them will be available at home and therefore be able to watch, you know, the program, okay. So I would have thought that, Chairperson, that research would have informed that kind of program, you know, for us to be able to show it, okay. Intentions may be good in terms of promoting women, especially in the agriculture area, okay? But unfortunately, we're not reaching the very target group, principally because the timing is wrong and dealing with all those kinds of things. So I've got to say, responding to that question, that if the research was not done, it sounds like it wasn't, because then the timing of showing the program should have been appropriate, at least for the majority of those mothers. Chairperson, I mean, I watch TV frequently. There are areas that I'm not sure about. If one looks at, you know, the kind of society that you want to build, if one wants to look at the value system that you want to encourage and imbue in the society, one of those values is the question of respect, for example, just to give that example. And you want the program, and then you want to use it on TV1, for example.
you begin to be, I don't want to sound old, you know, but you begin to be worried about whether we actually are building, you know, these programs are contributing in building the kind of society,
you know, that we really, really want to see one day being realized.
The use of language, for example, is another area that's of concern to me. Okay. Apart from the fact that maybe we're not using all the languages, you know, of our communities, but just the way language is being used,
okay,
is a problem for me. You talked about the question of education. Certainly, I mean, SABC is a wonderful vehicle. You know, I watch mathematics, for example, science, when it's being delivered. I enjoy that. But in other aspects of education, I just begin to wonder whether perhaps this process of delivering education and knowledge to our people is consistent with what we actually want to do in our society. So again, I will have to come back to, for me, the starting point in terms of saying, in all what SABC is doing, what are the essential underpinnings? The Constitution is the formula of things that we constitute. The Act is the formula of things that we constitute. And of course, we've got our mandate. How do we reconcile and make sure that we can harmonize all that in such a way that we deliver our mandate, but at the same time contribute to the reconstruction of our country?
Okay?
Both in terms of the value system that we want to be, both in terms of the equality that we want to achieve, and actually empowering others who are in disadvantage. And all that has got to be done on a kind of harmonized basis. I know sometimes these things can be competing better, but at the end of the day, you need to take a judgment that says, if we do this kind of thing, we are certain that this will contribute to the realization of a new South Africa that we're trying to do.
Dr. Chuma, thank you very much. I'm going to give you a moment to say what your closing remarks are. But if you say that, maybe you can just help me out. Give me one or two of your favorite programs on television, and why?
Good question.
Family Man.
Okay. Alright. My favorite program on TV. Is Ubango. The reason for that is it has something to do with tradition for me that I like. It keeps on reminding us as to where we're coming from. Okay. We may be in the city, but we're coming from, you know, the village. That's our background. We're coming from community. And that's what I enjoy about it. Now, my closing remarks, Chairperson, is that I believe that I could make a contribution to SABC board in a collective by bringing my skills that I've acquired over the years, skills that I've received over the years, and I've mentioned to you I'll bring value in the area of strategy and leadership. I'll bring value in the area of, in the areas of people management. I'll bring value in the areas of enterprise governance, especially corporate governance, risk management, those areas. I'll bring value, obviously, in the area of commercial, commercial services within SABC. I'll bring value, in my view, in the area of organizational improvement. Okay. Where are the areas of improvement? Content is an area of improvement. Programming is an area of improvement. Systems, I mean, one of the big things in SABC is obviously technology. Technology is very important as an enabler for us to be able to deliver the public good. And those areas will have to be relooked so that we can begin to inform in a balanced way, entertain in a manner that fosters and enhances the values and the kind of society that we want to realize, and indeed educate in a manner that would be able, that education would be able to impact on the emergence of the new South Africa. And I thank you.
So thank you very much, Mr. Kuchume, and good luck. We're finishing today with the interviews. We're starting the discussions on Friday, and hopefully Friday or by next Tuesday we'll have finished it. You're welcome. Remember, we are going to, if you want to stretch for 5 minutes, do that. We're going to get Mr. Shogo in, and we start in 20 past.
No, that's me. They can see the system. You take them, I think, that could have taken him back. Thank you.
We've got Mr. Sean Way. Welcome, Mr. Sean Way. Tell him what to expect, that he is going to start by talking to the CV, telling us about himself, one, and secondly, just to ask us to consider him for appointment on the SABC board. Mr. Shongwe we interviewed three by people. We left with about three more to complete that cycle. We shortlisted 37 to withdrew. We had nominees for 443 people. So it's been a very busy, hectic time. So you just have to assist us to make it easier for us as well. So I'm going to give over to you 2 to 3 minutes just to tell us about yourself. If you go to 5 minutes also to tell us why you want us to consider you for the appointment.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate having the opportunity to appear in front of you for the consideration. To just give you a short brief about myself, I was born, bred in Alexander Township, but was fortunate when I was in the middle of matric to get a scholarship through an outreach program, which I was involved with a school called Woodmead, where I was able to get a scholarship to go and study in the UK, where I did my A-levels between 1981 to 1983. Having done that, I was further blessed by being able to achieve a scholarship to go and study in the US at the Liberal Arts College in Connecticut, where I did an honors degree in economics and political science. After that time, I worked in Washington, D.C. for a bank for about a year, and then came back to South Africa, you know, which was a very decisive at that time, decision for me, you know, because having been fortunate enough to have gotten the scholarship, you know, and coming back, you know, to South Africa, most people thought that I was crazy to come back, you know, in those days, you know, but for me, it has always been important, having grown up in a township, that the blessings that I've received in terms of getting the education that I've got, that I need to do something useful back in South Africa. So I came back at the end of 1987, got a job for a while with the Center for Policy Studies at first, but soon joined Palo Rand at the time, because I've got a specific belief in terms of the role of business in society. I joined Barlow's, but soon thereafter, I was fortunate to be awarded a Rhodes Scholarship, which then took me to Oxford, where I did an MPhil in Management Studies. Came back in 1991, and stayed within the Barlow Rand group until
until just at the end of 1994, at which time I left and started my own business. Created a strategy consulting business. This was during the early days of transformation and BEE. The view that I took then was that it would be important as we move into our democracy, you know, that the things that we do as a country in terms of integrating previously disadvantaged people into the mainstream of the economy was going to be critical. Because if we don't get the economic integration, then our democracy, you know, that was hard-won would be futile. We'll end up in a situation where I believe, you know, Zimbabwe is, you know, today. To that end, I've built a strategy consulting business, which at the moment I employ about 70 people, and we are engaged in most of the public sector organizations such as Transnet, you know, and SARS, where, you know, the firm that I've built with the local partner for McKinsey, you know, are here. And because of the work, the kind of work that we do in the consulting business, I've always been approached in terms of helping corporates in putting together their BEE deals. You know, to that end, in 2000, I started an investment company parallel to the consulting business, where we helped both individuals and companies put deals together. And in 2002, we decided to do some of the investments for our own account and started heading the investment company and brought someone in to run the consulting business. And that resulted in about 2.5 years ago, where I managed to raise money to buy 25% of Barlow World Logistics. And because of the size of it, then I decided to sort of go in there full time to run that business. So I'm currently the CEO of Barlow World Logistics in Africa, developing that business. I took it over about 2.5 years ago. At the time, it employed about 800 people. Today, we employ about 3,000 people, and I'm driving the strategy into other parts of Africa. I've just come back from Angola last week. I've been seeing there, you know, as they're moving into their first phase, you know, of democracy and building their economy in terms of what, you know, what's going on there. In a nutshell, I mean, I'm one of those people who believe I'm more social than I am business. You know, but much early on in life, I took a view that businesses have a very critical role to play, you know, in society, because, you know, it is businesses that generate resources, and therefore we need to bring in different thinking into the business environment, you know, and I get disturbed sometimes in terms of like some of the initiatives which are taking place in the BEE space, where I feel that some of the important things that the strike was all about, you know, tend to have been, you know, forgotten. Know, but, you know, still playing that role where I believe that business should be catalyst for social change. And for me to do that effectively, I felt that I need to be, you know, not only a worker, but be an owner as well. And to that end, I have invested in a couple of things. And I'm here being nominated by some of the people in the sector because in 1996, 97, I invested in a company called, at that time, Laduma Film Factory, and now they're called the Bomb Shelter. This was a company which came up with the concept of the education series Yizo Yizo. So as a businessman, I've invested in that in a sense that I've identified Tebogo Mahlatsi at the time as one of the emerging youngsters who've got the talent. I've always believed that, you know, Tebogo has the capacity to be one of our five leads, you know, one day, you know, and he has done very well. I've invested in that, you know, but what I've learned during that time, because they had to deal a lot with the SABC, and I felt that, you know, the role that at the time SABC was playing in terms of encouraging and building the new talent in our country you know, was not what it should be, you know, and I've continued to invest in that company, and I've yet to make money. So from a company point of view, we see that as our, you know, corporate social responsibility, you know, and they've done a lot of work, but adjusting the industry is structured in such a way that is not conducive really to develop local talent, you know, in a meaningful way and give them, you know, the platform. So, and I've worked with them in terms of raising money, in terms of some of the work that they've done. And when they've asked me really to say, would I avail myself to be part, you know, of the SABC, I thought that that would be, you know, a good thing, because I believe that, you know, organizations such as the SABC, they are a national, you know, treasure, and therefore there's a lot that could be done through a medium, you know, such as the SABC, you know, and therefore coming from a business point of view, you know, what I think, you know, I bring or I would bring to a board of the SABC, you know, is ensuring that the corporate governance issues, you know, and the strategies that the SABC put forward in terms of the role of SABC as a national, you know, broadcaster in terms of playing a meaningful role in the transformation and deepening of our democracy, that is in place. You know, if you take education, for example, I think a lot could be done in a meaningful way. If you take, you know, issues, you know, of leadership, you know, the dissemination of information, I think, is critical, you know, and, you know, and the strength that, you know, the SABC, you know, could have if, you know, run, you know, to a large extent, you know, like, you know, like a business, you know, and I think organizations such as the SABC have to be sustainable, you know, in order to be able to do the things that they should be doing, you know, in a meaningful way. Therefore, I'll be bringing more of a business mindset, but in a social context, understanding that, you know, the SABC is not, you know, its role, you know, is a social one, you know. But I, you know, and I've proven this in my own businesses, that businesses could be run in a way that they are socially responsible.
Thank you very much. Egan? Mr. Shomer, open. I'm counting. Ms. Fox?
Well, just to kick off, thank you very much, and your CV is truly impressive, and one can only thank you for not only achieving what you have done for yourself, but your approach to giving back. I'd like to ask you, you're an Oxford Blue in soccer, you were an Oxford Blue, and you're obviously very aware of what has been happening with regard to the PSL and soccer rights in the SABC. Now, there is a view that get with the real world, sport is business, big business, worldwide billions, probably trillions, US dollars, and even over billions in this country, that you can't just free enterprise reign supreme, and that's the way it is, with certain limitations in terms of our law, in terms of, you know, the cast of setting down what our courts do, of international interest and so on and so forth. But my question to you is, where does that leave the ordinary citizen in the kind of emerging democracy that we have, in terms of equal rights for all, in terms of the fact that so many of our citizens will never ever be able to afford TV in the foreseeable future, pay TV. They won't be able to afford to subscribe to TV. So as a sports person yourself, how do you see that radio and the requirements of the majority of our citizens, certainly through regard to soccer, which is a national sport. Could you give us your thinking around what would be the way ahead? Have you given us any thought of the way around the impact of big business, the and I'd also just like to ask you some questions around your views on freedom of speech and the way you have perceived some of the issues, which obviously you can only rely on, I assume, on what you've read in the media. But with the board agreeing of the GCEO that the SABC should withdraw from SANET, and I will just read some quotes by the GCEO, because we've been told that there's an ideological battle. Some board members have told us that they perceive an ideological battle going on within the SABC. Now, how would you take the kind of quotes that say we, the SABC, cannot remain quiet while our mothers and our democratically chosen leaders are stripped naked for the sole reason of selling newspapers, given as a reason why the SABC is withdrawing from SANET, and that the kind of approach being taken by newspapers relating to certain events of which you're obviously aware, how inhumane and how far removed from the basic value of Ubuntu. Shame on you to have turned your back on your own cultural values for 30 pieces of silver, pretending to be converted to foreign religion and feelings of freedom. What kind of take do you have on these kinds of expressions of disgust and disquiet from the public broadcast studio towards the media, print media? And if you were on the board, would you have sanctioned
such a letter to be not only sent to Senate, but clearly coming to the public domain? Thank you. On the first one, without any doubt in my mind, I think, soccer is one of the most grassroots sports around the world. And therefore, the accessibility of that to the general public, it's very, very important. I think that soccer and sports in general can be used in a very positive way as a nation-building tool. And in other parts of the world, it has been used in a most meaningful way. However, when you then take that and put it in a business domain, context. One has challenges, and that's why I believe that it is important that we run our public institutions in a way that it makes business sense. Because if we don't do that, we end up running them to the ground and making them irrelevant. For me, watching that debate from the perspective of what happened there between the PSL and the SABC, I think there was some level of complacency on the SABC side, where there was an expectation that as a national broadcaster we automatically have certain inalienable rights that this thing will keep forever. And it creates an element, of which one might perceive, as arrogance and taking your eye off the ball, and where then the free market, encouraging free market economy, plays an important role, in our society, is then that balance, because if you take eye off the ball, someone else will come and eat your lunch. And therefore, you have to make sure, in order to kind of like keeping, on eating, that, you know, you are ready, you know, and you're always putting your best foot up. You know, just coming to Angola, one of the things which made me very sad is just to see, you know, how the Americans are moving there, you know, very aggressively, and the business that they are building there, you know, and we are 3.5 hours away, you know, as South Africans, we're not even, you know, that aware from a business point of view, you know. Therefore, I just think that, you know, given, you know, the importance of soccer, you know, I think it's a travesty in terms of what has happened in that particular, you know, thing. And I've seen now as well that, you know, the radio as well is kind of like going, you know, the same way, you know. And I don't think it's driven purely by capitalistic greed from the part, from the private, you know, broadcasters, you know, because I think that, you know, those people do understand as well that, you know, as private businesses, therefore, a role, you know, to, you know, to, you know, to, you know, to play, you know, and I think being, you know, a public broadcaster, you know, if the SABC had, you know, its eye on the ball, they would have lost kind of like, you know, that contract. So I think that, you know, I'm one always encouraging people to behave in a way that, you know, if you don't improve, you stagnate. You know, and this is a classical example for me that, you know, if the focus is in other areas, then you end up not doing that well in the things that you meant to be paying attention to. That brings me to your next question in terms of like that, you know, comment. You know, I strongly believe that, you know, it's going to be very important, you know, as we, you know, democracy, you know, at its maturest stage, you know, it's about choices. And it's about building a platform where people, where the citizens will be able to, you know, to make choices, you know, and partake in what our economy is all about, you know. And therefore, I think, you know, it becomes very dangerous when, you know, our public institutions become ideological, you know, one way, you know, or the other. You know, I think there has to be, you know, neutrality to say, you know, as the SABC, what is our role in society? You know, is it a party political role, or is it a role that should create, you know, a platform that, you know, particular, you know, things that really kind of, you know, help our democracy to be rooted are promoted, you know. I don't particularly agree with that quote because I think it looks at the thing from a very, you know, politically ideological, you know, place, you know. And if I was on the board, I would have reminded my fellow board members that, you know, as a national broadcaster, we shouldn't be, you know, either way, be party political. You know, we should be looking at things which, you know, are in the public interest, you know, as opposed to be in the IFP interest or DP interest or ANC, you know, interest, and therefore play kind of like that neutrality where, you know, those organizations should be seen and behave as unified, as being neutral from a political, you know, point of view. But then when it starts getting kind of like, you know, politicized that way, you know, then the danger becomes where, you know, where kind of like then the media can be, you know, hijacked to be used for party political, you know, reasons. And with that, depending on who is in power, you know, freedom of speech can go out of the window. You know, with democracy, sometimes things that people might not necessarily like to hear needs to be put in a public domain, you know, and that debate needs to take place without fear that if I'm saying this, I might be seen to be anti-this or not understanding where I come from in terms of my roots, you know, and
all that. But at the end of the day, you know, as we move forward, you know, we compete with the BBCs of this world, you know, and other broadcasters, you know, internationally, and we need to use, you know, treasures like the SABC, you know, where we really, you know, bring, you know, the culture, the arts, the, you know, what we, you know, what it means to be, you know, a South African, in a way that is productive and conducive. And that kind of like open debate, you know, for me, and the freedom of speech, it's one of the tenets, you know, of strong democracy. You know, once we do that, then we start moving into, you know, very dangerous, you know, places where people can't, you know, it's through rigorous debate that I think, you know, we will move forward and deepen our democracy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kumar.
Shall we just start from here, the BBC? Mr. Song, the BBC is public funded, but the BBC is cited as the shining light, stimulating all respect in terms of its content, focus, patriotism, and stuff like that. But then the BBC is supervised by and regulated by the Board of Governors, who are appointed by the Prime Minister, and without any input from Parliament, the British Parliament. Appointees come from, there's a perception that appointees come from a small elite of Westminster elite. Now, what is your view about appointment of the board? Do you think that in the light of the legacy, the historical problems that we had in terms of particular national groups is not given enough coverage over the years, would it be correct for us to have the board of the SAB appointed by Board of Governors, appointed by the Minister, or should it rather be this parliamentary process that we have? And I would also want you to note the following questions just so that you put them down. Secondly, is that there are quite a number of indications on what is the role and understanding of the public broadcaster. Now, as I want to ask you, in any event that you're going to be in the board of the public broadcaster, what is your view or understanding of the role and answer to the public broadcaster and the South African Broadcasting Corporation, and I guess in the interaction with the IPO in all its members, like as you mentioned earlier in your funding, there should be some bit of understanding in terms of what the SABC should, not what it is going through now in terms of its progress, but what it is supposed to be its role and function. And coupled with that, would you in any way, in an event that might have read the charter or the broadcasting, would you in any way understand its mandate? What is the mandate of the public broadcast? I'm sure the first and second question almost are interconnected. And finally, do you have an idea of the current funding model? Let me give you an example. I can give you three or four examples of the European Broadcasting Union, the UNESCO Jubilation, the BBC, the SABA, the Southern Africa Broadcasting Association, which is the association of all broadcasting states between the regions. They believe that there should not be much state funding and state interference. The broadcasters must be independent, impartial, without any political interference and must operate without fear of favor. Is that the way SABA looks at it? Now, would you really tell us if you understand the funding model of the broadcaster? In any event, do you think it's appropriate funding model to achieve its objectives and its mandate? Thanks.
On the first one, on the process of electing, you know, the board members, you know, I'm not familiar with the different models that you gave, but I'm going to give you what I think, you know, should be, the process. You know, I think one has to take into account, you know, that the SABC is a public broadcaster. It's not a private company. You know, there are, as a public broadcaster, there are social obligations, you know, that I think that, you know, they need to kind of like, you know, deliver on, you know, so therefore the process that needs to be put into place
needs to take into consideration that, you know, in our society we do have different, you know, stakeholders, and we strive to, you know, promote a culture where people from diverse backgrounds, that have, you know, different, you know, beliefs, you know, different cultures, you know, need to be, feel that they are part of the, you know, of the process. And therefore, you know, in choosing the people that are going to be the custodian and making sure that the SABC delivers on its mandate, you know, the representation, you know, as broad as possible, you know, acknowledging that it would be impossible to have almost each and every stakeholder, you know, involved. But it needs to be kind of like, you know, the process should have the credibility, you know, that, you know, it's seen as being representative in its composition. Therefore, I think the process that, you know, the parliamentary process you guys have been going through, you know, I'm assuming again that, you know, the grouping here, which is making that decision, is fairly representative of different, you know, stakeholders. Because if we're able then to get people who are not, you know, bringing in particular, you know, individual interests, but recognize that, you know, this is something that needs to be, you know, used in a general public, you know, interest, you know, and then getting those people who are strong and coming from different, you know, stakeholders, give an opportunity to have impartiality and balance, you know, on the board when, you know, issues, you know, are debated. That brings me to the sort of, like, you know, to the role. You know, I'm not, you know, so much familiar, you know, with the act in terms of, like, you know, the, you know, the broadcasting, you know, industry. You know, maybe I should have read it before, you know, I came here, you know. But, you know, but my view, I think that, you know, the SABC mandate, you know, should be, you know, the one which is aligned with those things that, you know, as a country we need to, you know, promote, you know, the arts, you know, the different, you know, cultures, you know, education, entertainment, you know, things like, you know, sport, you know, and sport again, you don't have, you know, only soccer, but you've got, you know, you've got rugby, you've got, you know, tennis, you've got cricket, you've got all these, you know, things that are in a public interest, you know, need to be, you know, taken account, you know, and make sure that, you know, the SABC, you know, as a medium, you know, delivers on those things, you know, in an appropriate, you know, and a balanced, you know, manner. The funding model. Because, again, that the SABC is, you know, needs to behave in a way that addresses, you know, public interest and public needs, I don't think that it should be funded purely on the commercial, you know, basis. Because if it's funded purely on the commercial basis, he who pays always calls the truth, you know, and people are able to influence one way or the other. I think there has to be a component that is public funds, which goes in there with a very clear mandate of minimum of what the SABC as a public organization needs to achieve. But having said that, on issues of sustainability, you know, and growth, I think there has to be a significant portion of that funding that is self-generated, you know, by the SABC itself, you know, and given what it can do, you know, to do that, I think the scope is very vast, you know, for the SABC, you know, to do that. You know, so from a funding point of view, I would go with a kind of like, you know, a mixed model of saying that, you know, it has to be, you know, to some extent funded, by the public, and that then gives rise to that obligation that that the broadcaster is going to have. It shouldn't only boil to what makes more money. Therefore, the thing that the corporation does depends on that. There has to be social obligations that are required, by the broadcaster, to achieve. But for the long-term sustainability and therefore the quality, of programming, there has to be an element of private, funding or generating funds from the activities that the SABC does itself.
Thank you.
Thank you. There's always a fear. There's always a fear when funding coming from government equals government interference or prescriptors to all of us. We've seen, when we take the Auditor General, and if you take the history of the last all the years, they've always been critical of all departments, including Parliament. So I have no fear, even a fully funded public broadcaster needs to be concerned about independence and interference from, let's call it, government side. But the question obviously is...
Point of order, the Audit General works on a cost recovery basis. Parliament has received its vote in a penny for as long as anybody can remember.
Can we just give up and then just notice that it's a matter that we take forward after Mr. Shaw is out?
The point I'm trying to make is that independence is very often construed that only if you should get funding of any support from government, there will be interference, which I dispute. The question then is independence only, as been again being reflected very often, the more anti-government you become, an anti-ruling party you become, that's a sign of your independence. The more you shout at government, the more you shout at whoever, anybody linked or related to government, in this case particularly the ANC, you seem to be accepted as more independent. Secondly, the question about, and I just want to hear your comment on that. Secondly, the question of PSL, which I also do pose to some of the people from time to time. The flip side of that is, we have women's soccer. There's hardly or anything, any time being shown on a public broadcaster. We look at netball, the second most popular sport at least on the continent. Hardly being shown, and when it does being shown, sponsored by Spa, it is not on that, that prime time. It's like at the time when everybody is at the top. You're 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock. Very seldom you find people at home to be able to watch it and appreciate it. So when we do talk about the whole PSL super sport SBC debate, I think it's also then try and bring on board the other things that I think that SBC is not doing right. Like I just mentioned, particularly like women's sports across the board, seriously neglected. And could either be misread because the public broadcasts are run predominantly by men. Maybe we should get all our board members also be women. And maybe we'll see a change of scenery in terms of what we see. No offense to you, Mr. Chongke. I'm just saying we have men all the time. And we seem to the detriment of women's sport.
Thank you. You've been very provocative, but it's fun.
Huh?
I say you've been very provocative, but it's fun.
No, not at
all. Yeah, but you can see the report later. Mr. Shaman?
The first one on top of funding and interference, I think that's why it's very important in terms of the people who end up on a day-to-day running some of our organizations, be it SABC or Transnet or the post office, that the issues of governance become very important in terms of is a mandate? Is a mandate clearly understood by the management, and are they kind of like held accountable for what that mandate is? And number two, as board members who are then put there as custodians of those entities, do they understand what that mandate, is? And I think if that mandate is well thought out, it should be a mandate, which is shared and agreed, on by the majority of the people, Therefore, to sort of equate government funding with interference, I think if governance structures, are in place, that shouldn't be the issue. And we should be developing a culture that, that it's not the issue, because, government is there for the people, to ensure that, government can levy taxes, government can raise, money in a way that, the private sector cannot do that, and that is done in the national interest, to build and to fund organizations such as the, as the SABC, which then allows it, to be, if it's part of the mandate that, the sports in this country that needs to be promoted is not only soccer and rugby, but there are other sports that need to have, the airtime, then it becomes incumbent on those who are given the responsibility to be the custodians of the, of the SABC in this case, to make sure that, there's a balance. Again, one understanding that there's no kind of like, unlimited hours where all sorts of things can be, shown, that there is gonna have to be, choices, and trade-offs. But within that, if there's a concerted effort and part of our, strategy is to make sure that, the improvement of women's sport. Sport is not only about men. It's about, women as well. Therefore, thou shalt create, time. And that government funding, gives one that authority to say, this is not only about which is a sport which is mostly watched. Therefore, soccer, therefore you can attract more advertising funding, because I think when it goes into that private, domain, it ends up being, evaluated in terms of how much, ad space, that the broadcaster can, raise. And that needs to be, that part of the funding needs to be balanced with the government funding. And therefore, that's why I think, in order to build, a very robust public broadcaster, which takes, into account things in some cases which would not be commercially viable, becomes, very, important. Because it's through that government funding which then addresses the issue of soccer, for example, in terms of like, what, we do have the funding to be able to negotiate with the PSL, to get the rights of showing, soccer, with a view as well where PSL has to understand that this is not only about commercial, but about business realities that they deal with on a day, on a day-to-day, basis, So I think the, the funding, where the funding is balanced between self-funding and private funding and government funding, give the broadcaster the leeway, to do some of the things where if you are doing purely for business reasons, you wouldn't be able to do it because it would become financially unviable.
Mr. Shambhat, thank you very much. I'm going to give you a moment just to say your closing remarks, and we wish you good luck. I've counted about six 50 gold and I think one truck registered in the are these all gold registered in? And how do you, your time, how do you manage your time to attend to the type of work that I see your face? You can just say whatever you say, but you're close to the bank as well.
Just to respond to sort of, the time allocation. I'm always, very alive to that, because, I'm one of those people who, by nature, tend to do a lot. And even the boards that you've seen from what they were last year, there's a lot which I've cut out. And I've realized that in terms of if I was to be successful in this process, that I might have to look at what I'm currently doing and juggle it around. I've just stepped down from the Anglo-American Chairman's Fund because, again, my new work at Value World is demanding, and I've just been put on the board of Value World. And I can rest you assured that I'm not going to take anything which I'm not going to be able to give time to, and I think my track record, if you talk to those people I've been involved in, with, the things that I take on board, I make sure that, I do put in the time, that, it's required. Just in closing, I think, some of my friends have been asking me, why are you making yourself available for the SABC board as if you're not doing enough already? Is it, an ego-driven thing that you need to be involved in almost anything, or do you think that there's something that you can contribute? So I've thought about that and I've reflected, on that. Like I said early on, one of my driving tenets is social change. There are a lot of other boards, commercial boards, which I've been invited to, and I've declined those, boards because I didn't see any further value that I would add, in what those companies are doing, but I believe that, SABC as a national broadcaster is one of very important elements, in our democracy going forward of how it could be used, as a tool. Therefore, I believe that in terms of how it's managed and how it's developed, it's very important. Therefore, I would like to play a role in that and bring some of my skills which I've developed in the commercial space in terms of how that should be handled in terms of enhancing as opposed to not adding much value, to our democracy, However, I must say that, there's an element of me which is, a bit concerned in terms of like where we end up, because, again, in order to have, I've captained a couple of soccer teams, so I like to use analogies on soccer, teams are not made of individuals, teams, they're called teams because they are made as a group of people, and there are functional teams and there are dysfunctional teams, you can have teams with a lot of individual talent, and find that those teams, don't win the game, don't win, the World Cup, and you can have teams with average players, but because they play as a team, they end up winning, championships, at the back of my mind, I'm concerned about, the team that you guys end up with. There's been a team which has been in place, and it's clear that there has been challenges, with that team. Whether it's been a team or a bunch of individuals, you know, we should all judge that, you know, individually, you know, but because, you know, you can still have people there, but if those people aren't able to get, you know, to work together as a team, it makes a tough, you know, a very, you know, difficult one. You know, so in closing, at the back of my mind, you know, there's a niggling feeling that in terms of your process, you know, how you are, you know, running it, you know, if one, you know, ends up, you know, on a team, you know, which is very clear that, you know, it's a dysfunctional team, what are the options of, you know, those team members, you know, to stay on or to, you know, to, you know, to opt out. But I think that one will cross that bridge when one gets there.
Good luck.
Thank you, Bob.
I don't know where this is finished or where this was a soccer player.
He's a cousin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Chairman, could you just advise the Honourable Speaker that I don't wish to see women's net more on TV? and I don't. Do you really think there are going to be large audiences?
Well, maybe let's get to Ms. Nemani Balan on the side so that we get right away to the next. And I'm hoping that members will.
You.
Thank
you. Chairperson, I would love to see Ms. Smart Meliutas on a netball court. Chairperson. Chairperson, you know.
Thank you very much. Members, we continue with our one Masala interview. The session before we take the telephonic one later. Oh, let's take it over. No problem. Yeah, as you settling down with the Mali Balan, enjoy your water and so on. I'm going to ask you just to talk to your CV, basically to tell us about yourself and to answer the big question. Why do you want us to consider you for appointment on the SABC board, the term that we are going to recommend to Parliament? I want you to start there, but for just your background information, we had 133 nominations, which was listed to 37. We then had two or four. We interviewing, you are the 33rd person that we interviewed. So after this, we'll take this as we do there, and then we'll do another one, which is the teleconference. You can just start off by doing what I requested you to do. Talk to us about yourself, relax. And it's okay to be nervous. I have not seen anybody sitting there not being nervous, so don't worry. If you are, even the experts were very nervous when they came. And I can tell you I'm enjoying it from sitting there. Keep quiet with the manual.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Thank you, members of the Parliament for the Commission of Communication for inviting me.
You're very soft spoken.
Am I?
Take charge of that one. You are in charge there.
You know, when I start, I only start slower and I go up. I'm saying thank you, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable members of the Portfolio Commission on Communication for shortlisting me and inviting me to come and express myself. My name is, as explained in my CV, I'm Nomanzo Chume Mani Balani. I'm from the Northwest Province, and then but based in Johannesburg. on work relations. I'm an advocate there. I run my practice, my small practice. I'm also a member of the Commission on Gender Equality, part-time member of the Gender Commission. And then I also serve some various boards in the government. I'm serving in the tribunal, in the Department of Transport. I'm also a legal advisor of the Veteran Council of the Department of Agriculture nationally. I know I did not mention the just when you asked. Why do you have to consider me? I think because I've considered the leadership, and I think I would have an input, you know, a constructive input in the board. And as we all know, that the mandate of the board is to inform the public, is to educate various sectors in our community, and then as well as to entertain. And if I'm part and parcel of the board, in terms of information, I admire what SABC does, but in some extent, I find that it becomes very difficult because the information that we get, particularly from the news, you know, it creates much of fear and then an uncertainty in the community. Because, for example, if I can mention one case, the case of Mr. Kevin, who passed away, we all knew that he died, we all knew the things there, but we do not know what happened to the perpetrator. You know, we do not get that information. And I think the public and members of the society would like to know the end result of the perpetrators, because we all know that South Africa is under threat. There's a high rate of crime in our country. And then an institution such as SABC can utilize information in order to ensure that we participate in eliminating the crime that exists in our country. And then in terms of education, the input that I can do, I acknowledge and I appreciate the information that you get from the SABC, but sometimes I think the information you have to be, you know, you have to be in a consultative manner and also in a partnership manner. The information, you know, from various sectors, for example, if the SABC gives information for people with disabilities, I think it would be wise to make partnership with people with disabilities and also know what they want exactly, rather than the institution offer the information without consulting those institutions, without consulting those stakeholders. And then in terms of entertainment, I appreciate it. Entertainment that we get, but sometimes that personally it becomes too much. You know, the pornography that we see sometimes, you know, it also devalues our society, and then it also undermines the identity and also the culture of South Africans, because we all know, irrespective of our race, irrespective of our ethnic group, and irrespective of our political backgrounds and otherwise, that we were brought in a society that had a culture of ensuring that, you know, that pornography was never there when I grew up. Pornography was never there. And I think most of you, when you grew up, you never knew anything about pornography. But then the unfortunate part, when we came into our democracy, you know, everything just took an opportunity. You know, you look at the level of living. You know, I'm saying in journalism, we see these things that are happening. You know, some of the things are happening, you know, behind the doors, but things that are happening today. And I think the SABC can play a major role to eliminate such activities. And the other thing, why I think you should take me, the emphasis, I will put my emphasis on partnership with local production companies. You know, what is happening now, personally I'm talking from outside, and I'm also subjected to corruption. I think what is happening now, you find that the local production companies, they sell information to SABC, and then like the situation of a buyer and seller, or data and creditor. And if I say, I would advise, as a member of the board, I would advise that instead of creating such a situation, let SABC have a certain percentage of ownership
for a sort of a partnership so that the FACC can be able to influence those productions, so that the FACC can also influence the culture, because we really need to see the unity and the diversity of our culture in the programs that are happening in that institution. And then the partnership further, I will also look at partnership further at bigger institutions, such as government departments, for example. Government departments, for example, if let's say you talk about the Department of Treasury, for example, you can form a partnership with the SAPC in the sense of looking at the financing of the institution, because I think currently the institution relies on advertisement, of which I don't think that is the right way of leading for an institution. You know, the institution needs to sustain itself without relying from any other sector or from any other organization. And that reliance creates, you know, or either it compromises the independence of an institution. And then if I talk about partnership with the Department of Health, for example, we all know in our country there's a problem about the HIV and AIDS. You know, there's a problem of translating the information or problem of interpreting the police. You know, there are tensions with some organs of the civil society together with the department. And I think SAPC can play a major role or a central role of bringing these parties together, of ensuring that where these organizations are critical, and then you can translate that information to the community. Because I think, you know, public is not interested in the differences. Public is not interested in the court cases. Public is not interested in who wins what or who loses what. But the public, when it comes to this business, because this is a threat to our society, you know, it's a bombshell to our society, because we cannot tolerate a society where you find that every day there are people who are dying of this killer disease. And I'm saying that if FACC then can form a partnership with the Department of Health together with those stakeholders that are dealing with HIV and AIDS issues, and perhaps maybe, you know, that can also advance the discussion so as to ensure that, you know, there's more research, there's more constructive way of dealing with these issues, such as perhaps maybe suggesting that we come up with a medicine, whether it's herbal medicine, whether it's a drug that can assist in preventing transfer of HIV from a man to a woman. We know that there are ARVs that have been accepted in our country that are used to transfer to prevent the disease from a mother to a child. But what about from a female to a man? I'm saying then, if we talk of partnership, such discussions can be advanced. And then the other role that I can play if I'm a member of the board, I will make the point that the promotion of gender equality is taken on board, and I will ensure that there is no unfair discrimination in the institution based on race, based on gender, based on ethnic background. I think those are
the few that I could. Thank you very much. You were in the process answering a lot of questions as well. Let me start with last one.
Thank you.
And if that takes us, please indicate that we continue.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good afternoon, advocates. You have mentioned such a lot of issues. I just want to ask you which of your experiences you have mentioned, your experience and your skills, would you really impart if you were to 7 or 6 now that you feel that so many areas are coming into it, and how would you recommend? The other thing is how would you manage your climate change all the board and the area that you are serving in. And you have been nominated here by South African National Civic Association. And one of the things that their responsibility is mobilizing people to organize and entertaining people. Therefore, I think that you are really concerned about what should the SABC deliver the company. These are the business sessions. Yeah, business sessions. And I want to know what, how would you handle the last. You have just mentioned that you have been an activist at gender issue. And you are also, I know you are part-time gender coach. And how would this gender equality institution really implemented in mainstreaming this in the institution? Because we have a concern here in Parliament also that institutions like SAPC, ELCOM and all the others, we want to see gender mainstreaming, how it goes. Maybe you will be of assistance here in the sport.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Because I was just going to ask whether it might going to wait for a number of questions of answers. Thanks, Mama Sol, for your question. The skills that I think I will bring to the board will be my leader skills that I did not mention much, but I think they are placed there in the city. And they're not only leader skills, and I would say that I am running the party, the financial skills, because I think that is a critical area. And that is the area that I've raised earlier on of partnership. I'm not exactly whether did I raise the partnership between the Department of Treasury and the board. I might over decide the financial part of it. Because at present I think the SABC is relying on advertisement. I think it gets 80% of its funding from the advertisement. And I've indicated that that compromise is its own. I think it is compromising the independence of the institution as a whole. And then I think, you know, I can come up with some suggestions. Of course, you know, I believe in working in a team, I believe in a teamwork. And then I can share information. So the small practice that I run, financially sustainable, that is why I'm able to serve here, I'm not serving there, and I serve there, because I also look at my countries as well. But then the practice that I do, I take only 4 cases per month. I don't take more than that. And then I know that if I take a case that you then transport, then I will take a piece that will be less transported, then I will take a correctional service case one day in a month. And then, unfortunately, you know, on media issues, because media is my interest, but it did not get much. I once got one media case, but then it did not go anywhere. We had to settle outside because it was not a real challenge case. So I make a point that I don't take more than 4 cases a month. So in that office, I've employed about 4 people. And you know, they are satisfied. They are satisfied. I'm not always in the office because on Tuesdays I go to commission. If I do not, I'm not on trial. I make a point that when I'm going to motion court, it's only one week that I deal with all my motion matters. And then on Tuesday I'm not in my office, but my office is always running professionally. Today I am here, I know the work and the business of the day continues in us. Because of one reason, that the job satisfaction, everybody is happy in my office because of the way people are being paid, because of the way we bring money and also sustain the office. And then I think then that is the experience. And practical experience, because I do not have the academic experience of financial management.
my dad on his own, I think I can assist the FABC, and then I will tell you later what you are doing. I will answer my vision about the financial management of the FABC. And then about the time management, I think partly I've answered that. I do not take more cases, more than 4 cases in a month. And then in the board that I serve, like in the veterinary council, I only put the one in 3 months because I'm just a legal advisor there. And then most of the work they just send it to me. And then we do not have much inquiries because I also chair the committee that deals with the inquiries. So we do not have many complaints. You know, the veterinary profession, few people, and then there are not a lot of controversy. And then in Transport Appeal Tribunal, the Transport Appeal Tribunal, what happens is, we find that sometimes we have one case in 2 months in East London, and then maybe 1 year in Cape Town, and then we've never had any case in North West. Since I started to serve in 2005. And then we have never had any case in housing. You know, there aren't many issues. Sometimes we find that we need only 1 to 2 months, sometimes 1 to 3 months. So it does not only be one. And then when we talk about the Commission on Gender Equality, the way I've structured myself was like this. In Gender Committee, I'm supposed to work 100 hours. But then I've decided that I work 80 hours. Doing teaching work, and then I'm also responsible. I'm the chairperson of the legal committee of the teaching. So what I do is most of the time, you know, because I do not have a husband, so I keep most of the time drafting opinion, assisting the department of legal. I sit down, and then I do some work of the commission. And then every Tuesday, I go there and check what is happening. And then, but at the moment, you know why I go there every Tuesday? It's because the HOG of legal is on the city. So now there's a bit of a crisis. So every Tuesday, my Tuesdays is for CGE work. My Saturdays and Sundays is for CGE work. And then basically that's it. And the CGE, you know, I do not do a lot of traveling on CGE. I always like to do the practical work. Actually, you know, I think I like to do the background work most of the time. I think that I've got the passion of working. And also, you know, it also gives me relaxation. If I've been taken earlier on, you know, I'm just a single mother. And then I've got time with my children every day when they come from school to stay together. And then I believe the craft. And public, you know, that's a very challenging question, I must say. But the way I see, you know, I've been appointed by a, you know, by a specific organization, and that specific organization has nominated me because they've realized that, you know, their views are not heard up there, or they are not represented. And I think we all know, or we all always assume that the FABC is a public institution. And then if you are talking about a public institution, the public would need to influence such an institution. So by nominating me, they think, they see me as a link between the public, not only the civic members, also women, also the CCD, because CCD has also supported my nomination. They congratulated me after they said that I'm taking. Because, you know, you find that, you know, when you look at women's programs, you know, sometimes, you know, you see the women's programs of a certain group. You know, as women, you know, for example, you are political women. You are political women. Do you think, are you well represented with this? I do not think you properly represented, because maybe you can tell me after all that, no, you are well represented. And I see most of business women, you know, those individual issues, you know, about women who are going up on top, who are millionaires, etc. You know, SABC reflects such things. And then about, you know, women in the civil society are not reflected very well. I don't want to talk about women in the village. It is
very well. He only can explain it when you see a very rich man go into the villages. That's why he see those women. But you do not see women from the villages. You do not see, you know, when they display their culture, when they talk to issues, when they deal with the issues of abuse against women or the gender-based violence. You do not see that. Because, you know, we've got various, as I'm saying, you know, as women, we are broader. And I'm quite certain that gender is not only about women's issues, it also addresses the issues of men. But the challenge that we have at this point in time in South Africa, we have a challenge because we know we are from a patriarchy society. So those are the issues that I think I can look at. I think I can influence to do that on. And then on the gender mainstreaming, I think partly I've also dealt with that. I know the SIPC talks on this policy that it is a gender mainstreaming structure, and then it reduces the numbers of women in key positions. But it does not mainstream and look at the bottom, who is at the bottom, how many men are there, how many women are there. At the bottom, how many men and women in the middle, how many men and women are up there. And then they will always talk about one individual woman who is the manager of the section, and then but then you find that many women are just up. And the eyes know, even within the institution itself, you know, there's still an outcry, because I was invited at some stage by women in the media. I think I'm going to address them sometimes this month, I'm not sure. They feel an outcry that, you know, the local production companies are predominantly men-owned. There are very few women production companies. And those that are there, those few female production companies are there, you know, they are only dealing with women's issues. And the women, they want to have production companies that deal with engineering, for example, that deals with other challenging issues, not necessarily in the confines of the main issue.
Thank you very much. If you just switch it off,
thank you, Ed. You are going to be a part-time gender commissioner. Yes, you are going to be for the next 5 years. I've just got a couple of questions. You say you're dealing with legal issues. Could you just give us very briefly some idea of the kind of issues that are coming to your attention? You can keep it very, very brief. And then I want to propose to you that there is a perception that the Gender Commission, since its inception, has been somewhat of a disappointment to the general public at large and women in general, in that it hasn't seized the ground that it could have or should have. It has been racked with internal problems that has been well publicized over the years. And that it would appear, you must correct me if you think this assumption is wrong now that you're in the heart of it, as it were. It would appear that for the most part, it's not really enjoying the confidence of a lot of women. You look at the annual report and you see the major problems that are in Syria and so forth, but its trajectory into looking at proper, my colleague, when she talks about the gender mainstream, I mean, the kind of budget analysis that should be being done. Some idea you think it's being done. And finally, I'd like to a report has come out involved in looking at a review of our Chapter 9 institutions. And that report concluded or recommended that consideration be given to subsuming. I'm loosely paraphrasing what it said, but that consideration should be given to subsuming Gender Commission into a broader human rights body. Obviously, this must have been discussed now with your colleagues, and if you would feel comfortable. principle with either your views or the views in general, should you wish to give us some idea of what that is. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The Commission on Gender Equality, I must mention that I was only appointed president of the Commission on Gender. I must mention that I was only appointed to serve in the Gender Commissioners from the 2nd of May this year. And then I think we are there. I said, I'm over 100 days. I'm quite certain. The issue, the legal issues that we're dealing with presently in the Commission on Gender Equality is to ensure that there is an establishment of equality courts in all areas. And it was realized that, you know, there are equality courts. We've got less than 85 equality courts in the country, and we've got more than 250 courts. So that was the challenge that we realized when we arrived. And then now we are in a program of ensuring that we are establishing that equality court, and then that we are doing through the Department of Justice. And then the other thing that we do, we deal basically with the, we get complaints that are related to gender-based violence. We've got a complaint manual. And then people do come, but apparently, I must say, I agree with you that, you know, there has been lots of things that have been said, negative things that have been said about the issue in the past. And that was taken into consideration. And perhaps maybe that is why I am a part-time commissioner today, because, you know, I was one of the people who ensured that we established such an institution. And then, again, I was one of the people who also criticized the Commission on Gender Equality. But then, today, I am part and parcel of that institution. I want to see to it, that it be, you know, controlled by public. Because I think basically the problem that the CCD had in the past, you know, it's publicity. You know, CCD, I don't think CCD was publicizing its program efficiently to the public. They do have good programs, but then not many people know about the Commission on Gender Equality. And then the other issue that we deal with is the issue of unfair discrimination at workplace, and then generally, part and parcel, you know, as in terms of the mandate of the city, is to ensure that there's a promotion of gender equality across the board. That is our duty. To think of it that this parliament, for example, is the biggest institution in the country, that it practices the promotion of gender equality. That is our duty to think of it, that we monitor that. And then to think of it that in government departments, that those gender focal points, together with the Statehouse of Women, that, you know, the issue of gender promotion are taken care of, and that promotion, because it's not only for the benefit of women, it's also for the benefit of men, to see to it that we live in a free and democratic society, and a society that recognizes the human image of all. And then you are saying CGE has been a disappointment. Yes.
Many organs of civil society have been complaining, but this CCE is not working. Probe so doing what you want. But when you look at the report of Professor Kada Asma, after the report came, the same organizations who were criticizing Commission on Gender Equality, they are saying, you know, there's no way that Commission on Gender Equality can be part and parcel of the human rights issue. Because we need to redress the aspect of discrimination. We need to see to it that we promote the gender equality in our society. So we still need a structure that is gender commission. And I think the disappointment, I mean, the criticisms of each and every structure will always be there. And then constructive criticisms, I take it, you know, as a build-up of an institution. And then the issue of budget analysis. I must say to you, as I've indicated, that you have just been appointed, you know, what we are doing as a new commissioner, we attend each and every meeting, like last week, Tuesday,
as I said, as I indicated earlier on, that, you know, my two things, I sent the Defense Commissioner General. We went to address the committee that deals with the medium-term expenditure and so on. And then, you know, we wanted to get the gist and the problem, you know, as commissioner, to find out what exactly is the problem. And unfortunately, it was tabled to us, and now we know what is the problem, but I cannot disclose that, because that is an internal problem that we are going to deal with. About the internal problems of the CCD, I think the problem with the CCD, you find that, you know, people come and then they go. I think that's the major problem that the Commission of Gender Equality is facing. People, they apply, they get in there, and then they, at the end of the day, you find that, you know, they are not experienced for gender issues, or they do not have passes for gender issues, and then they come and go. You know, if you have institutions such as like that, you will always experience problems. But then we have decided to set up a structure, a recruitment structure, that will ensure that people that are brought on board are people who understand gender issues, and they are, in addition, are people who are having passion to deal with gender issues. I think I've covered all the questions.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Mark?
The apologies of my colleague, Advocate Paul Swartz, and Gender Women's. I just like to, you know, we're tending to discuss now issues that are not directly relevant. Your appointment. One of the things we need to feel sure about before we recommend someone for appointment is that candidate board members will be committed to the freedom of expression. And I, you say, but I didn't get a sense that you had a really full understanding of how things work at the SABC. And I'll give you an example in a second. And then secondly, your general approach just worries me a little bit, if I understood it correctly, which is why I wrote it. It was on the matter of the production scene on SABC that I thought maybe you don't have quite the full picture. You said you thought it would be a good idea if the SABC with the producers had a kind of a partnership arrangement so that the SABC had a bigger say over what was in the program. But that is not, you know, how it works. I mean, the SABC or any other broadcaster, if they're buying in material from overseas, for example, so you either buy or you don't buy, you're exercising your choice, spending your money. And as for local productions, the SABC commissions them. When you commission, you actually set your requirements. And if a producer produces a product which hasn't met those requirements, then they go away and they have to edit and bring back and so on. And the SABC holds the copyright at the end of the day. So that is actually how it works. If you thought that they were somehow the passive victim of whatever is available, no, that's not the answer. But the other thing that worries me a little bit about your approach is you seem to me to have quite a didactic approach, and I see there is an educational qualification in your background. We all care very deeply about our people and our country, but, you know, When you get to the field of the media, which after all you should understand, I mean the place of the media is not to provide a platform for whatever your view or the department of this, that, and the other view on something is. For example, you say AIDS is a terrible problem in our country, agree. And you think that we should be putting on programs in which we tell people what the school drugs, you mentioned both. Are available enough. Now, you know, a kind of a public health education program, I'm sure there is a place for it, but it seems to me as though you had an overall impression of what the public broadcasters should be doing, which is a kind of a, let's look at what's good for the people, and then we'll tell them what is good for them, if you'll forgive me. That's the impression I got. Whereas that is not remotely how journalism or broadcasting works. It's certainly not the requirement that is set for you. In the law, because we are devoted to democracy in this country, and that is, as the previous candidate just said, that's all about choices. So when there are lots of views on an issue, a plurality of views, as the Broadcasting Act calls them, then the public broadcaster must reflect that richness of views, the diversity of views in our country. And when you get the whole richness or the diversity, that we all together arrive then at the best possible insight. And we aren't all ever going to agree on everything. But it's a democracy, so you're supposed to give facts. So you sounded to me quite didactic, and you sounded to me as though you felt that you knew, you feel you know what good people, and that that should be the platform which you tell us. And if that's incorrect impression, you would kindly tell us.
Thank you. I must appreciate your comment. And then I know that you are living in a democratic country. And then the expression, the expressions are out. And then you know we also need a clean personality in our country. Thank you. I'm saying we need also to create a platform for creative journalism. But then because I am not a journalist, and then I know that the things that are happening in our country, you know, I accept what is happening in our country, but I am trying to come up with a sort of solution. Because you can hear the diverse of views, that is acceptable. But then I think me and you, at the end of the day, what do you want to learn out of the institution? Do we want to hear about murderers, about rape every day, about what, but not the solution to the issue? Let's hear about it. But then my critical point is, the solution, at the end of the day, people are being raped almost every day. We hear a taboo, an information from our broadcast that such and such a 9-year-old child has been raped, but then what happens to the perpetrators? I think that is the critical issue, and I think that is the lack in the SABC. You know, because you cannot just, like for example, you cannot tell me today what has happened to, I've mentioned one case of the late Mr. Kerber, that we heard about his death, you know, it was highly publicized. But then the process of dealing with that, of dealing with the perpetrators, nobody knows about it. We heard about the death of Kenzani, the small baby on the mother's back, but then you don't know what happened to the perpetrators. We heard about the Bele children who were killed on their way to church. But then what happened to the perpetrators? They were freed. Because it was said there's no enough information. So what I am saying is, you know, this country, you know, the media in this country, particularly when it comes to information, it has created a situation where it creates fear to the people at large. And I think me and you can agree on that. Because every time when you look at the media, you just wonder, who has passed away today? Who has been raped today? Who has been, you know, molested and all those other things. I think that is the critical problem that we are having. And that is why you find that we are having big wars in our houses, you know, which was never used to be before. There's a crisis of crime, but I'm saying, you know, you cannot utilize the media to perpetrate that crisis that exists, but you can rather use the media to resolve the problem that exists. And bearing in mind and also acknowledging the freedom of expression and the creative journalism. Thank you. I must thank you for the comment that you've
given. Thank you very much. Mr. Kumalo.
Sir, thank you very much. Sir, the candidate, the advocate, Memani Panani, has actually disorganized because ordinarily I asked both of the candidates what is the mandate of the broadcaster, and in the course of informing you why she must be taken into the broadcaster, she covered that. And then which also she attended, and I guess in the course of answering, she also became a bit political. And there are also views that could dispute some of the things she said. I'm just saying, I mean, that's the reason. But I guess that chapters and the issue of the money is quite clear, but Ms. Malami doesn't have to check with you. Do you in any way or another understand? Because if you spoke about the money, you should know the funding model of the broadcaster. That's to ask you the first question. If you know the funding model of the broadcaster, and second thing, what is your view about sex and violence on our screens, on television? And whether is it from the independent producers or is it from the American, whatever? And finally, do you have a proposal on what should be a funding model for the broadcast that can really help us, in particular for the mandate as it relates to education and information? Those are our only questions. And as the rest of some of the ones you asked earlier, she in the course of the opening, they are covered.
Thank you very much. I think it will be the last.
Thank you, Chair. Before I go to the funding model of the SACC, my understanding of the funding model of the SACC, let me deal with the issue of sex and violence. And then when I deal with the issue of the local production, I must thank the Madam there for trying and correcting me. I think most of the things, I think I related mostly on the international production, whether the buyer and the seller, and then and the seller situation. You find that the programs that SABC gets, or the package of programs that SABC buys from outside countries, most of, or some of the work within the package is not educational, and then it does not promote Ubuntu, what we call Ubuntu. And then you find that, it's a foreign culture. And I think I indicated it, maybe perhaps not directly earlier on. I indicated it when I was talking about entertainment. I indicated it in it. And then you find that, the same package, with all those products, you find that some of the production within the package is not educational, as I said, and then it does not promote the culture in our society. And it creates a problem because, the children that we are bringing up, they are not learning anything. They become, I don't want to use the word coconut, but they become too artificial. They do not become themselves. They do not become, human beings, as the way we grew up as South Africans. And they lose South African identity. And then you find, that production, even though SABC has got a right to go and buy and whatever, but then whatever it can buy, I think it can also say, this is good for the country, this is not good for the country. So you find that some of these products, they are sort of what I can call, the cheap product. The South African right wing is the Hong Kong. We use Hong Kong. The cheap and invalid product. That's exactly what is happening. And the other thing, South Africa is part of the global world. As being part of the global world, I think also South Africa can be taken and say, okay, I buy this package from you, but you take this out, and then you also buy this from me. That will be also another strategy of ensuring that you fundraise for the production. And then let me go. I'm saying it's not acceptable. The certain violence that we get in our media, particularly from the outside production, does not educate our people, and it does not change this country anyway, because it loses the identity. It makes our children to lose their identity. And then in terms of the fund model, my understanding is, and I'm subjected to correction, of course, is that SABC gets 80% from advertisement. And I've indicated earlier on that compromises the independence of SABC. And then I think it gets 17% from the licenses, of which I think it's a good step. The SABC needs, the 3%, I think it gets the 3% from government. But then, all in all, what I'm saying is, SABC needs to come up with a very strong way of ensuring that it must, bring the culture of payment. It must promote the culture of payment from the people. Because I know South Africans are prepared to pay, But what campaigns are there to ensure that people obtain their licenses? And perhaps we can come up with a strategy of ensuring that, you know, you pay your licenses through the electric bill, or you can partner with the Department of Treasury, look at the revenue, and then perhaps maybe the license fees can be collected through that manner. And then right now, government can contribute, but then I think what is important is that SABC will need to have its own financial muscle that will ensure that it is sustainable, that will ensure that it does not rely on a certain institution or a certain organization for its sustainability. As I've indicated, you know, it can also sell its own production outside. It can also, you know, it's part of the global world. It can also extend its licenses. I know it has got the commercial license and the community license, and then I think it has got three, I'm subjected to correction, it has got three or four community stations and two satellites. And then it can increase its satellite stations so as to ensure that it gets more money. It can also further to that. It can also further to that utilize the communication, because it has got a mandate to fundraise, and the interest of the act, you know, does not stipulate that the SABC can fundraise in this sense and not fundraise in this sense. It can also create its own newspaper article. There's nothing that SABC not to come up with its own newspaper article. There's nothing that prevents SABC not to come up or partner with the cellular company and ensure that it brings more finance into its coffers. Because I think the crisis, not necessarily the crisis, I think the problem out there now, you know, is this dependency of SABC to other such. I hope I've covered.
No, you have enough. Thank you very much. I did not pick up your technical side that was picked up by Islam. But obviously she was not being like your former student to say how you present the case. But that's fine. I'm going to give you a minute just to say your closing remarks. And to also wish you good luck. And you know that we are excited that we are about to finish. Members of the Sabrina outside. No lunch today. Okay, let's just finish with you first. Lunch the item.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm not going to be long. I think, you know, if I can be considered to serve in this board, it will be a learning curve for me. And then I think I will try, you know, to prove whatever resources that I have. I'm talking about experience, I'm talking about academic resources that I have, so as to ensure that we build a very strong broadcasting institution in this country. And I will make the point that, you know, the public has a say in the institution.
Thank you very much, Mr. Zaman Balani, and once more, good luck. Members, we're going to take lunch until 2 o'clock. And from there, we should go straight to S26 after lunch. We'll take RSSGWAT for 15 minutes, and then take Mr. Bulele. Okay? That's what we're going to do. The meeting is adjourned.
S26.
Yeah. The one that we need, where we need the...
Andrew Barron, sir. Andrew Barron, sir. You get up the stairs, man. Out of the, where the library is, on that part.
No, the last one was 635.
Oh, okay.